Welcome to yet another episode of the AANS Practice and Business Management Podcast. I'm your co-host for today's episode, Paul Camerata, and I'm here with Lior Elkheim.
Hello, everybody.
Lior is a fourth-year resident at McGill University, currently working at Neuralink. So everybody needs to pick his brain regarding this, so to speak, as you're doing it at Neuralink. But our guest today, we are just thrilled to be able to interview the chairman of neurological surgery at the University of Pittsburgh, Dr. Robert Friedlander. Dr. Friedlander is really a phenomenal neurosurgeon. I'll just give you a little brief bio here. He is the Walter Dandy Distinguished Professor and Chair at Pittsburgh and co-director of the UPMC Neurological Institute, a position he's held since 2010. Before Pittsburgh, he came to Pittsburgh from Harvard Medical School, where he was a professor and vice chair of neurosurgery, the associate director of cerebrovascular surgery, and the co-director of the Neuroscience Research Center at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. Today, we're going to be talking about communication, but I'll just go through a number of significant awards Dr. Friedlander has achieved. Most significantly, an induction a few years ago into the prestigious National Academy of Medicine. So for those young neurosurgeons who may not know, election to this academy is considered one of the highest honors really in the field of healthcare and recognizes individuals who've demonstrated outstanding professional achievement, commitment to service. He's also received the Bayer Cerebrovascular Award from the Joint Section, the International Charcot Prize for Motor Neuron Diseases, and the award from the Academy of Neurological Surgeons. In addition, the H. Richard Wynn Prize from the Senior Society and the Distinguished Chancellor University of Pittsburgh Research Award. He is an elected member of the prestigious American Society for Clinical Investigation and the Association of American Physicians. As a sign of his prominence as a clinician and scientist, he's one of a very select group of authors to have been invited by the New England Journal of Medicine to not only write a basic science review, as well as a clinical review in management of AVMs. He focuses on the operative management of complex cerebrovascular disorders, brain tumors, and Chiari malformations. His major research interests lie in the study of the mechanistic pathways of the caspase apoptosis gene family. His work includes evaluation of the treatment strategies for neurodegenerative diseases as well, such as Huntington's and ALS, stroke, brain trauma, and spinal cord injury. He was actually the first to demonstrate activation and a functional role of caspase cell death pathways in neurologic diseases. His research has, in addition to receiving significant media attention, he's published in many of the most highest impact journals with publications in Nature Science, Nature Medicine, Nature Neuroscience, and 8 in PNAS. And for over two decades, he's had continuous NIH support as a principal investigator. Directs currently a busy and prolific laboratory in addition to his clinical responsibilities. He has served on the National Advisory Council of the NINDS, and a rewarding aspect of Dr. Friedlander's activities is his involvement in organized neurosurgery. He was a member of the CNS Executive Committee for a number of years, chair of the Research Committee, the Membership Committee, and the Publications Committee in the CNS, and directed for a number of years the very well-known RUN course, the Research Update in Neuroscience for Neurosurgeons at Woods Hole, for over 15 years. He's a native of Caracas, Venezuela. Dr. Friedlander came to the U.S. in 83 and earned a joint BA and MA in biochemistry from Brandeis, graduated from Harvard Medical School, went on to fulfill his internship and residency at Mass General. Robert, welcome to the AANS podcast.
Well, thank you, and a pleasure to be here with you today.
It's wonderful to have you here. And you know, specifically, I guess before we get into sort of best practices in communication, my question would be, after going through this bio, how do you do it all? When do you have time to devote to the significant research interests that you have in addition to a busy clinical practice?
One of the things in a motto in my life is make every moment matter. And if you're going to do something, try to plan for it and be directed to what you want. Figure out where you want to go. And once you know where you want to go, decide how you're going to get there. Try not to do things that don't matter, don't make an impact. And when you're starting your career, sometimes it's hard to figure out. And during residency, it's important to work very hard, be dedicated, and define what is it that you want to do. The earlier that you figure it out, the farther that you're going to go. But you have to be very directed. You want to look, you want to have mentors that allow you to get to places. You want to see, who do I want to be like? You're not going to be exactly like somebody, but you can be a hybrid of several different people. But it's important to have mentors and role model, but to really, really be directed. What is it that I want to do? And make plans that sometimes take years. But if you want to aim high, you want to plan exactly for what you want to do, and then go for it. As an example, I always think of, if I want to get a science or nature paper, I'm not going to get one every year, or a New England Journal paper, but you can work for 3 or 4 years. And at the end of that time, you, once you figure out what you wanted to do, then you can get there. And, you know, I find that a lot of people go through the busy nature and busy time that we have in our life, in our career. You know, neurosurgery is very busy, and obviously you can spend all your time doing neurosurgery, and it's a very fulfilling career. It's amazing to be able to, every time I open somebody's cranium, it's an honor to be able to do that to somebody. And that in and of itself is terrific, and it's a career. But what's important is for people, and that's what I give advice to my residents and young faculty, decide what you want to do. Think of your life in 5-year chunks. What's the big accomplishment that I want to have at that time? And then very carefully plan for it. Make every moment count. That's what to me is really important. One of the things I tell my residents is, I always walk fast.
Yeah.
Because that second that you wasted walking slow, you're never going to get back.
Dr. Friedlander, it's really an honor to speak with you. Personally, you're an inspiration to me and to many other young neurosurgeons. Dr. Camerata touched on your incredible bio. You were also one of the youngest professors at Harvard Medical School, and you moved from Harvard Medical School to become chair at the University of Pittsburgh, which is one of the larger neurosurgical centers. I'm wondering how you approached starting that new role and leading a lot of really high octane people who have maybe a lot of different interests. Like, how did you communicate, and what was your approach towards that sort of 5-year window when you were starting as chairman?
So being a new chair, you learn on the job. There's no book that you read on how to be a chair. And you learn by doing things right, and you learn by doing things wrong. And sometimes we learn faster by doing things wrong. And the one of the things that I learn very, very quickly when you're in a position of leadership is that every word matters. Mm. Everybody listens to your words, and they can be interpreted in many different ways. And you have to be very, very careful when you speak, how you speak, what do you say, to be fair. The first thing is, you want to be fair, because if you're fair and you're being honest, you don't have to remember anything, because you're always telling the truth and you're always being honest. And that's critical. That's one part. The other part is emails. Anything that you write is there forever. And you have to be very, very, very careful. And, you know, we're all emotional people. And sometimes things happen that might upset you. And you might want to react and write an email. And sometimes you write an email. But before I press the send, I always read my email one more time, and often I'll delete it or I'll modify it, because that's one thing. So as a leader, everybody listens to you, and everybody takes, and sometimes things could be misconstrued. But if people know who you are, the kind of person that you are, I'm not going to say you get the benefit of the doubt, but it's always interpreted in the way that you hope it's interpreted. But, you know, there's no book on being a chairman. And the key thing is to be fair. To me, leading by example, I want to do, and I'm not going to say I'm the hardest working person in the department. I may be, but I always want to make sure that I'm there. I'm there early. I stay late. I work hard. I go with my family. You know, you really want to try to cover every single thing that you can.
So you've touched on one of these, or several of them, best practices in communication that work with your team, you know, holding on to emails, maybe even until the next day before sending or changing it. What are some other best practices in communicating with your team you could help us with?
One thing is always, you know, be very directed and understand what it is that you want to say. And again, the same way as we spoke at the beginning, is have a plan. This is what I want to communicate. There are different forms of communication. Some of them are ad hoc and, you know, in conference, for example. Yeah. Some are in faculty meeting, or when I have to address the department for certain things. And you want to make sure that you cover certain things. You want to have a map in your mind as to what it is that you want to say. These are the three key points that I want to make sure I put across. I am very clear. I give people the opportunity to ask me questions and discuss it either in front of everybody else, or I always invite people to come back afterwards and talk to me. Some people are not comfortable in discussing certain things, and I want to make sure that my door figuratively is always open. If mm-hmm. anybody wants to come in and talk to me, I'm always there. My phone's always on. You know, we work 24/7. We're there all the time, and people need you in different times. And I always tell my faculty, I want to know of issues when they're small, because often you can fix them and take care of them rather than when they're big, when they're much more difficult. So to me, what's key is just being honest all the time, so then you don't have to remember anything, to make sure that you're fair with people, congratulate people when they do something well. We work very, very hard, and sometimes people just expect that, oh, this person's supposed to get this award, or this person's supposed to get this grant or this big paper. Always to make a, yeah, make a big deal. When somebody has an award and with the good things, make them public. And when there are issues and problems, obviously keep them private, but to talk about them and be open about them and just be totally direct and transparent about them.
Dr. Friedlander, another question that I had, you said there's no book on being a chair and you learn on the fly. And obviously a lot of this comes from your experience. But as someone who's obviously very forward thinking, what is your vision for the University of Pittsburgh as chair?
You mentioned that we're the largest department of neurosurgery. But I mentioned that from the point of view that we're on the academic side, because we also have a community side to our practice. On the academic side, we're doing so many cases that people are very, very subspecialized. And one of the things that I am incredibly proud of is the prowess of our surgeons. Mm. They are just clinically amazing. The kind of complex cases that come to Pittsburgh from the region, from the country, and from all over the world. And when I walk into the other ORs and see my partners operating, I'm incredibly proud of what we're doing. Sometimes I call our program the redo center of the world. Because so many cases come where they've had the first or second surgery somewhere else, and then they come to Pittsburgh almost as a point of last resort. Mm. And we get very, very good at doing these very complicated cases. And I'm very proud that then our residents get very good at them because they see and they work with us. I get comments from our resident alums when they go to other places in terms of they're so grateful in their technique and everything that they learned and their ability to, you know, tackle the most complex cases. Or I hear from the chairs of wherever our alums go to, and they don't have to tell me and be as effusive as they are. And that's something I'm incredibly proud of in terms of the academic abilities, but also the clinical abilities to be a doctor and a surgeon. That it takes a lot of hard work, a lot of long hours, but we have an amazing group of residents that we're fortunate to be able to train.
As you continue to lead the department into the future, talk to us about who you recall that influenced you in your leadership skills, your communication skills, you know, dating back even maybe when you were young, certainly through your training. Are there any mentors you turn to or you remember in your style now?
I would say I am a hybrid of, I don't want to say many people, but probably it is many people. Mm-hmm. Residency, I remember in particular Dr. Bob Ogeman. Well, what a gentleman. Yeah. Just an amazing person,
that, yeah.
Incredibly caring. He knows all his patients by first name. He's got charts of everybody, incredibly methodical, cared about the residents, met with the residents, was with us. He would always sit in the corner in the room when you're opening for an acoustic with him. And always every 6 months, and you're going to get into the sinus one time.
Yeah.
And he's there sitting in the corner, and it's nice to get, you don't want to get into clinical trouble, but it's nice to get into clinical trouble with him right behind you.
Right.
And
sure.
Seeing how he managed that, his calm demeanor, it's something that I have taken, and that's what I do right now. So I'm a little piece of Bob Ogeman.
Yeah,
and I'm
sure.
And I sit with the residents doing aneurysms. Usually it's a PGY 5, 6, or 7,
sure.
And I'm sitting next to them. I'm just there, and you know, with my Penfield 4, I go in and help them and direct the operate, but
right.
They're there, and we can spend hours, however long it takes. And I learned that from him, to be there. So on the clinical side, Dr. Ogeman was a role model. I had the fortune to work with Art Day also for a number of years when he was at the Brigham, and still a great friend, an amazing surgeon. His knowledge of anatomy and his way of teaching is just second to none. He probably knows the anatomy around the clinoid and knows how to draw it better than anybody else. I still call him every once in a while, send him a picture. Hey, what do you think of this? And I might just send him one picture of one angiogram in one plane. He'll just know everything about it, and he'll give you a little kernel of information. That's great. And then I've been fortunate to have a lot of scientific mentors. One was when I was at Brandeis, when I did combined BA Masters, and Michael Newman was his name. Is his name. He's still around.
Yeah.
And he dedicated so much time to me that I'll never forget in terms of it's learning how to do science. When you think of an experiment, how do you do an experiment? How do you ask the right question? Is it an important question, and how to answer it? So those were all great mentors and role models. And as I am in my role now, you got to figure out who do you turn to for help? Who do you turn to for advice? I'm fortunate to have Dave Lunsford around me.
Obviously
an icon in neurosurgery, a magnanimous kind of individual that's a person I turn to. Joe Maroon, with anything. Joe knows everything, and he's just very calm and will always have an answer to things. So you always have to think in different stages of your life and in different kinds of problems, almost like having a Rolodex. Again, the residents won't know what a Rolodex is anymore, but it's a Rolodex in terms of it's the contacts on your iPhone.
Yeah, that's right.
And really just know that people that care about you, and actually I have many others, and that to me, maybe one of the things I've been most fortunate with is having people around me that care about me. Mm. So I could call Henry Brim and with problems. I could call Alan Friedman. I could call Isama Watt. I could Bob Dempsey. Just people that are such amazing individuals that have been through so much and understand and know it. And you just need to know who are your friends, and you have to be lucky enough that they respect you, that they both not only give you the time of the day, but also give you their emotions and effort to give you advice.
That's great advice.
Dr. Friedlander, you'd mentioned a couple times during the interview about working on important problems, problems that are important in the field of neurosurgery and beyond. Do you see any problems currently or any challenges that young neurosurgery resident or even a young medical student can tackle and that you would describe as particularly important in neurosurgery?
I think every day is even more exciting to be in neurosciences and neurosurgery. We need to reinvent what we do. There's a lot of things that we do very well, but a lot of things that we're still horrible at. I mean, think of glioblastoma. Mm. We've made progress, but we're just still way, way behind. We had an amazing talk yesterday, actually, from one of our residents, Camille Nowicki, who's speaking here at WNS about his talk in the WNS about aneurysms. How do we do a blood test to, you know, detect aneurysm formation, aneurysm growth, and then develop a therapy for aneurysms? So if we can actually treat all the aneurysms with a drug, obviously it would put us out of business.
Yeah,
but that's what we
got
to do. We have to do things for our patient. The opportunities with AI, artificial intelligence, virtual reality, using all the tools that are out there, we need people that are able to bring them into neurosurgery. Mm-hmm. And if it's a neurosurgery resident, that gives them a great opportunity to bring this and to change neurosurgery. And we all need to be willing to change and understand what's the new thing. You know, you mentioned in my introduction that one of the things I do are Chiari malformations as an example. So, you know, what did I love to do 10 years ago? I still love to do them. Brainstem cavernomas, complex posterior circulation aneurysms, and difficult tumors. And for reasons which not sure that I fully understand, I also became a Chiari surgeon because I had a lot of patients that you have to know how to listen to them and study them. And we have a lot of great studies on them, understanding that, you know, there's a lot of psychiatric issues with a Chiari. So having the ability and desire to change and adapt yourself and see how is it that you can move the field forward is something that we all need to do every day.
So Robert, they don't teach you how to be a chair in residency or how to manage people. How did you come to learn about that? And what's some advice you might give to other younger neurosurgeons who aspire to be leaders in the field?
It's one of the things that we talked about is mentorship. And where do you look for people that can mentor you? And at different stages of your career or different positions that you're in, you really want to have people that you can trust and can mentor you around you that are important. And as I took the position in Pittsburgh went through a little bit of a shaky situation as I was going in there. So I went with my eyes wide open, and I was very comfortable where I was at the Brigham. There's a good chance I could have been chair there or some other place if I stayed there, if that's what I wanted. But the University of Pittsburgh, I saw it as a place with incredible potential. It's a huge place. UPMC is a great institution. The University of Pittsburgh is a great medical school. But I wasn't quite sure what I was walking into. I knew that it was a terrific place, and there were two individuals there, the dean of the medical school, Art Levine, and the head of the physician practice, Marshall Webster, who's a vascular surgeon. And I knew that they had my back, and I could trust them. And for me to make that leap to go into a position like that, into a huge department of neurosurgery, was something that I did with a lot of thought, some trepidation, but a lot of excitement. And knowing that there were amazing people around me, as I mentioned, some people that were there already, Joe Maroon and Dave Lunsford were people that I knew that were there. And the faculty were just amazing. There was just an amazing faculty that needed, as I saw it, a calm and steady hand to push things forward, being fair all the time. And you know, I've been there almost 13 years now, and it's been an incredibly exciting and rewarding journey.
Well, we're honored to have you as our guest today, Robert. And I had one question that I kind of shift gears at the end of the podcast that I usually ask people. Bruins or Penguins?
Penguins.
That's a good political move there.
Penguins, Red Sox, and Steelers.
There you go. Red Sox and Steelers.
The coach of the Steelers is my neighbor. So, and if you're not a Steelers fan in Pittsburgh, you take your life in your own hands.
Yeah.
But it's very exciting.
Fantastic.
Sports town.
Wonderful to have you as our guest, the Walter Dandy Professor and Chair of Neurosurgery at Pittsburgh, Robert Friedlander. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us on this episode of the AANS Practice and Business Management Podcast. Tune in next week for another exciting guest.